Blog Talk Radio.
And now, broadcasting from the banks of the historic Vermilion River, amidst the rolling prairie, cornfields, and unsightly wind farms of central Illinois, it's the Rhino Hour of Power, with your host, Rick Moran, like Diogenes without a lantern. And welcome all to the Rhino Hour of Power. I'm your host, Rick Moran, and joining me tonight in the second chair, the wild, the wonderful, the wacky, Jeff Kropp. Jeff, how's it going, boy? Jeff, you with me? Whoops, hang on. Yeah, I think I clicked the right button now, Jeff. Is that you?
It's me, brother.
Oh, well, that's a relief. I had somebody else call in there, and, gee, I hope I didn't hang up on David Goldman.
Yeah, I since he's our guest tonight, yeah, I hope you didn't either.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Well, I don't think it was. I think it was just some random caller, probably wanting to swear on air, which is why I don't take calls anymore. Seriously. You know, you remember some of those calls. And now we'll take a caller from whatever area code 514, and the guy would start spitting expletives, you know. So I just stopped taking calls.
I know. Well, you can call me the Randall Tex Cobb of the West Coast, then, huh?
You like that? Did you like that? I thought
you
that
are,
was brilliant.
Well, it was. And true to form, you are an absolute rhino. You're a Ted Cruz-hating, conservative-hating rhino. And you spare no... I thought it was brilliant. Randall Tex Cobb, that's good.
Yeah. I thought about that this morning. I don't know what I remembered that fight, that Larry Holmes fight with Randall Cobb, where it was so bad, it got so bad. Holmes was looking at the referee in about the fourth round. You know, stop the damn fight. Stop the fight. I'm going to kill this guy. And, of course, Howard Cosell then quit ring announcing after that. I like Cobb quipped after that. He says, maybe I should, you know, if it gets him to stop broadcasting football, I'll join the NFL for a week. Good guy.
Well, I can tell you're still on your jihad against Ted Cruz. Well, I have to tell you, he gave not since Ronald Reagan have I heard a conservative give such a moving, inspiring, and powerful speech than what he gave yesterday. Truly.
Crickets chirping.
I'm not alone. There's a lot of people who think so. And what's interesting is that I watched Rachel Maddow last night. Now, I have a hard time watching her at all, but I really wanted to know what she was going to say about Ted Cruz. And she, in fact, I tweeted about this, Rick. She gave a number of backhanded comments to Cruz about certain things that he was saying and directions he was headed. So I thought it fascinating. I think that, yeah, he's first out of the gates, officially, of course. And Bush's announcement of exploratory committees and all of that really accelerated the timelines here, Rick, as we know. But I was surprised that Cruz came out quite as early because, as Rachel Maddow pointed out last night, his websites aren't working.
Yeah, and he doesn't have the domains. Evidently, some liberals bought up the TedCruz.com and he doesn't want to sell it. Which, you know, that's not looking that's not forward thinking. That's not the kind of thinking we want in our president. I'll tell you that right now.
Well,
I'm just kidding.
You know, you hire people to do that stuff for you. What you want is a president who can stand up and articulate values that resonate with people, and that's what that guy did yesterday. And even though, you know, you hate him, you've got to admit it was a hell of a speech, Rick.
No, it wasn't.
Crickets.
It was full of hyperbole and exaggeration.
It was a fantastic speech.
It was full of hyperbole and exaggeration. Now, the fact checkers were ludicrous. I hope you enjoyed my taking apart the USA Today fact checker. Did you like that?
I did. I thought that was pretty good.
And a couple of others on liberal websites were also just ludicrous. I mean, you know, now, the USA Today fact checker, and I didn't even bother to get his name because he's a nobody, said that Cruz said that millions of people had lost their insurance because of Obamacare. Well, that's not true, because the net result is that more people are getting insurance. Well, yeah.
No, I think you're wrong. I you're absolutely wrong, Rick, because you just said
no,
net.
There are 11 million
people
who signed up for Obamacare and about 5 million who lost their insurance for a net gain of about 6 million. That's not the point.
Did the 5 million lose their insurance because of Obamacare? Did they?
Yes. Of course they didn't. I say that.
What he said. All right. So you said that. So why do you continue with beating up on Ted Cruz?
Well, I defended him from the fact checkers. But as far as a paranoid.
I appreciate that.
As far as a paranoid loon, yeah, the world is on fire. No, it isn't. No, it is not. That is hyperbole and exaggeration.
I haven't heard him say that.
He said that in New Hampshire to a 3-year-old little girl. Your world
that the
is
world
on
was
fire.
On fire. I mean, I guess
that's
if you look at
top.
What's happening
Sorry,
and after you
top.
Burn a, you know, a Jordanian pilot alive and, you know, chop off the 20 heads of the Coptic Christians. Yeah, I guess you could say Obama's foreign policy has the world on fire.
You know, there was war before President Obama came to office. I'm really sorry to inform you that the world was screwed up, has been screwed up since the end of communism. With no, U.S.-Russia restraining their proxies, the proxies have gone nuts. So, you know, war is war, and it's always been with us. I don't know. It's probably worse in some areas like the Middle East, Central Africa. But it's better in others. There are fewer revolutions, for instance, in South America. That's not Obama's doing. Not
so,
for sure. Not
so far, as long as the Iranians, you know, are pumping money into Venezuela now, we'll see how well that works out for you. And of course, Bolivia, you know, the move to the left, you're totally ignoring, which is why you're a rhino.
No, I'm not ignoring it. I have not ignored it. I've written about it.
Okay, all right. So all right.
Well,
you forget
that
I was into Bush's wars. All right, we'll
get back to Ted Cruz. Name one major piece of legislation he sponsored and gotten passed.
Freshman senator, virtually nobody else has done the same either. That's a moot point, you know that.
Mike Lee.
What he did do, however, is he stood firm and help shut the government down, which, by the way, didn't apparently hurt Republicans in the next election. Did it, Rick?
Did it?
No, it didn't. We picked up 9 seats in the Senate. We have a historic number of Republicans in the House. Come on. Didn't hurt anything. But it did for a change.
It doesn't matter.
The
question is, was it the right thing to do? Was it the conservative thing to do? Was there any chance
down?
You know, we've had this discussion before, Jeff.
To stand on principle? Why wouldn't it be?
It's not standing on principle. It's standing on the King Canute school of thought. Utter futility. Utter futility. There was no way possible that Obamacare would be defunded.
But here's the problem with your way of thinking, my friend, is that they said the same things about Reagan when he said, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall." He was derided and ridiculed for that, and he stood firm on principle. And you deride and ridicule Ted Cruz and conservatives like me who believe just about every principle the man articulated in his speech yesterday, believe in it powerfully. He spoke to a group of people who haven't been spoken to by a Republican for a long time. And, Rick, I got to tell you, everybody else in the Republican Party that is running for president had better take notice. He just inspired a lot of people to have hope again.
Well, we'll see. I mean, if he ever gets above 10%, then I'll start looking at him. But you know, right now he's at about 5% in the polls. And if he does better than that, that's great. Fine. It'd be great if he did get the nomination, because Peter King says he'll jump off a bridge if he does.
Well,
and I would love to see Peter King jump off the George Washington Bridge. That would be great television. Great television, I tell you.
It would for sure.
Yeah.
Now, I'm excited. I thought that there was an interesting piece by Ben Dominic that was on, I saw at Hot Air earlier today, about, you know, three ways that Cruz can actually win the nomination. Rand Paul hasn't come out yet. I think Rand Paul is going to be a formidable candidate. I think, frankly, Scott Walker has huge momentum, you know, going into this entire issue. And frankly, so does Bush, you know, especially on the fundraising front. So the question, I think, for Cruz is, can he get enough money from, and I happen to know of several billionaires that are very interested in helping him. And, it's going to be fascinating to see how the money flows. And you can't count out Christie. I think Christie's just really getting spun up right now. A lot of people have said he's been real quiet and, you know, don't pay any attention to him right now. He's not, you know, he's behind the curve. I don't think so. I think you got to watch out for this guy.
Well, I didn't read that Domenici article, but, you know, one way that Cruz can do it is if the Rhino vote, if the establishment vote is split three ways.
Yeah,
that
right.
leaves the door open right. for a conservative. Which one, I don't know. I mean, they're going to be splitting the conservative vote four or five ways. Remember that?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, so where does Rubio and Walker fall in the establishment conservative kind of camp? You know, they're both kind of straddling that fence, if you will. And you've got Huckabee out there. Who knows if Kasich will actually jump in? I mean, there's just Santorum clearly is going to run again. Foster Freeze is already behind him. So, I mean, just looking at, you know, it could be interesting to see conservative vote being split as much as the Rhino establishment vote. And, boy, how does that play out?
Yeah.
Not to mention my two friends that are running Donald Trump's campaign, by the way. Two guys I work with, I know very well. And Trump apparently is serious now. You know, and of course, he came out immediately with the birther comment on Cruz yesterday, which I don't think served him well, frankly. But, you know, it is what it is. So who knows? Where does Trump fall in the middle of this? You know, he talk about a bomb thrower.
Yeah.
You wait till Trump gets spun up.
He's a joke. This is a vanity run on his part, for sure. There's just maybe he's trying to promote another TV show. Who knows?
Who knows?
I don't think he's a serious candidate. He's got zero experience at doing anything except making money, which is great. Good for him. God bless him. Go America. But hey, you need a little bit more than that to be president of the United States.
Well, you're right, and you bring up an excellent point, because you know as well as I do, especially from my time serving in the legislature, you have to compromise to govern, right? And
that's one of the realities,
Trump,
that a lot of people blame. Trump is a negotiator. Mr.
Right.
Cruz
he
does not apparently believe in compromise, though. So,
right.
You know,
well,
how is he going to govern?
You know, in negotiation, though, you still have to compromise to a degree. The thing that I think Trump brings to the table, which he was on, I don't know, he was on Fox yesterday or maybe early this morning. But, you know, Rick, he said, when asked about the Iran deal that Kerry and Obama are trying to cut, he said, you know, you walk away. In negotiations, you have to be willing to walk away. And in this case, I don't think the president is, because he's looking for
no.
a legacy. And
yeah.
so, you know, Trump, it would be interesting to have Trump push the envelope on that issue, I think, in the campaign.
Yeah. Kerry should have walked away the first time that Iranian nutcase foreign minister screamed at him. He should have picked up his papers and walked
yeah.
out the door and gone home. You know, American
Amen,
diplomats
brother.
Should not have to put up with that crap. You know, let Iranians sell it to their own ignorant peasant people. don't try and take it out on Kerry. You know, Kerry's a fruitcake, but that doesn't matter. Well, I'm going to take a chance here and see if this is our guest for the evening, the David P. Goldman, also known as Spengler. Let's see.
Spengler
David,
is online. Good evening, Rick.
David, I'm sorry I hung up on you earlier. I thought you were some random caller waiting for get on air and swear at me.
Well, back then I was, but now I'm Spengler.
You're on the air with Jeff Kropp, political
Hello, Jeff.
Consultant from Oregon.
Hi, David.
David, of course.
Wonderful to. Yeah, I'm a recovering radio talk show host, and Rick used to. Come on my show every Fridays, and we would yell at each other then, and we're still yelling at each other now, David.
Yes, yeah.
It sounds like a productive thing to do. I was enjoying the yelling before. I'm perfectly willing to listen if you gentlemen care to yell some more.
No, maybe we'll yell at you, although I think we're all in agreement pretty much
I'm not going to yell at Jeff because I'm a big Ted Cruz fan. I don't know what his chances are, but I'm a great admirer of the senator.
Oh, good. Okay. So you can yell at me. That's fine. All right. Let's get serious here, because this is a serious show, mostly.
It is. Mostly.
By the way, I should say, by way of introduction, which I totally screwed up, David is a columnist, regular columnist for Asia Online. He also has a column with PJ Media. He's an author and a Middle East scholar. And I wanted to talk about Iran to start with, because you wrote a very provocative piece a couple of years ago, actually, but that you republished on your blog recently, about Iran and its perverse culture.
Yes,
and,
well, that's right. Iranian classical culture is essentially gay kiddie porn.
Gee.
Okay. That, by the way, is not a controversial view. That is the standard scholarly view. The supposed great classical poetry of the Iranian Middle Ages, the great Iranian civilization that you hear tell about from our president and Valerie Jarrett, is about sexual attraction to prepubescent boys. It's a disgusting culture. And Iran has become a disgusting society. It's one of those great and important cultures which, if it happened to become extinct, most normal people would not miss.
Yeah, and you also mentioned in that article some remarkable statistics about sexually transmitted diseases. Just incredible.
Well, here's the great mystery, Rick. Iran has the fastest rate of population decline or fertility decline measured anywhere in world history. When Khomeini came into power in 1979, the average Iranian woman had 7 children. Now it's down to 1.6. Nothing like that has ever happened before. That portends a catastrophic aging of a population, which has never happened before in a poor country. And one of the reasons for the fertility collapse appears to be that they have the highest rate of infertility among women and men in the world. nearly a quarter of Iranian couples apparently can't have children. And a likely explanation for that is they appear to have the highest rate of STD infection anywhere in the world. For example, chlamydia, the most common, you know, yucky STD infection, which causes infertility in women, has an infection rate of less than 1% in the United States, according to the Center for Disease Control. In Iran, spot estimates in different places range from 12 to 24%. So we're talking about a deeply corrupt, lascivious, promiscuous society. A lot of this is driven by the fact that Shia Islam has an institution called temporary marriage, which turns the clergy into pimps. In other words, if a woman wants to make money, she'll agree to temporarily marry a man for a specified period of time, 4 hours, 24 hours, whatever. They go to a mullah, and they get a stamp of approval. They sell a little marriage, temporary marriage license. In other words, the mullah becomes the pimp, and they're married for that period of time. After that, they're no longer married. Plus, you have enormous amount of street prostitution and so forth. It's a corrupt and dying society, which in my view makes it extremely dangerous.
Well, they also lost a great number of eligible males between the ages of, 14 and 50 during the Iran-Iraq War. I mean, that was a genocidal conflict.
That's true, but most societies can pretty quickly recover from casualties and war if they want to. The Iranians appear to have given up on the idea of producing a new generation and are too busy enjoying themselves in whatever ways the Persians are known for enjoying themselves, with the result that they're a deeply sick and decaying society. They're a society which knows they're going to die. They know that 3,000-year-old Iranian civilization is well past its best use-by date. They're an apocalyptic regime, let's say, with a lot to be apocalyptic about.
Go ahead, Jeff. Butt right in whenever you want.
So David, I have to tell you, I have read with fascination your article there, because in my personal experience with having been boots on the ground with a combat infantry unit in Iraq and Afghanistan, I have never heard what you've written about articulated regarding Iranian culture, and I'm fascinated by that. So I guess the question I would ask you: if they are a dying populace in general, are there population numbers declining in total?
Well, not yet, because you have an enormous generation that was produced in the late 70s, early 80s, when birth rates were still very high. The absolute numbers aren't declining, but they're becoming old very quickly. It's kind of like one of those Indiana Jones movies where the villain goes from being a healthy 50-year-old to a skeleton in about 3 seconds. In the case of Iran, they're going to have an elderly dependence rate higher than that of the United States in about 20 years. But they're a country with about a tenth of our national income.
Right.
There's no way a poor country can afford to support 40% of its people in retirement. It just doesn't have the economic base to do that. We may go bankrupt trying to do that. If, as our population ages, we worry about the Social Security system, we worry about retirement, and rightly so, and we have 10 times the per capita income of Iran. We're wealthy enough, we just might squeak by. This is going to kill Iran. Their population will start declining in about 15 years. An absolute
fascinating. In your mind, David, how does that play into what I think was a salient comment you made just moments ago, was that you believe that this scenario makes them, as a dying culture, makes them more dangerous? How do you see that wrapped up in with nuclear weapons and our diplomacy with those folks now?
There's only one thing that would save them, and that's to seize the oil of their wealthier neighbors. Eastern province of Saudi Arabia, just across the Persian Gulf from Iran, that's majority Shia. The Iranians are already engaged in subversion there, and eastern provinces where the largest amount of Saudi oil lies. Azerbaijan, to their north. Azerbaijan used to be called Northern Persia. That's the great reservoir of oil in the Caspian Sea. Basra province in Iraq, southern Iraq. If the Iranians can grab their neighbor's oil and run their little Shia empire for profit, that will get them by. And effectively, our administration, in its criminal misjudgment, is enabling the Iranians to expand this empire and become a regional hegemon in the Middle East. And, of course, nuclear weapons are principally there as a shield to allow them to engage in subversion, depredations, invasions, and so forth against their neighbors.
Could you talk a little bit about the competition with Turkey to be the regional hegemon? I mean, is there real competition there, or is there kind of a Nazi-Soviet type of situation where they're going to divvy up the Middle East?
Turkey has ambitions to become the dominant Islamic power in the Middle East, but it has been very cautious about taking on Iran. It's helped the Iranians get around sanctions. It's done a great deal of smuggling for them. It had a gold trade going with Iran, which was enormous, which allowed Iran to circumvent certain banking sanctions. Turkey is not going to take on Iran directly. The one area in which they conflict, of course, is in Syria, where Turkey is determined to get rid of the Assad regime, and the Iranians are backing the Assad regime. So there's a proxy war going on between Iran and Turkey right now, but I don't believe that Turkey is going to use military force in Syria, and I certainly don't think they're going to intervene in Iraq, which is the most important theater. So Turkey is trying to play all sides and really is not going to contest Iran for that dominant role in Iraq. You simply have the proxy war in Syria.
I believe you wrote a column a couple of months ago about Iran and Islamic State, and how it's a mistake to try and unite ally ourselves with Iran to fight Islamic State.
Well, I
because in the end
they're both. Prime Minister Netanyahu said it very well in a speech before Congress: "The enemy of my enemy is my enemy." This is a complex situation. When in 2006 the United States, in our great wisdom, supposedly, decided to impose majority rule in Iraq by forcing Nouri Maliki on the Iraqis, that created a permanent Sunni insurgency. The Sunnis had run Iraq for 100 years, even though they were the minority in Iraq. And once you put the Shia in power with American authority, the Sunnis became convinced they were going to fight for their survival against the new Shia majority. And unfortunately, ISIS has become the dominant rallying point for Sunni resistance against the Shiites. A lot of people from Saddam Hussein's army, a lot of people whom General Petraeus trained during the surge with the Sunni Awakening, the Sons of Iraq, have teamed up with ISIS, so we have a real mess on our hands. In my view, the best thing you could do is contain that conflict, let them kill each other, keep them away from Christian minorities, keep them away from the Israeli border. But unfortunately, we've set loose a monster there which we cannot call, we cannot recall, we cannot make it go away. So as a result of our past misjudgments, we've got a permanent war there. And the only question is it going to be a small and limited war or a big and very destructive war?
Yeah.
I hate to sound so grim, but that I think that's how it is.
Well, yeah. I think you're being realistic because it, having spent some time over there in those cultures and working with people there, I think what you've described is aptly correct. And frankly, in my time, especially in Iraq, I saw the what I thought was the mistaken direction by the Bush administration in in giving the State Department so much free rein to really direct the affairs of both our military and our interaction with Iraqi officials. And I think it ultimately, you're right, so many of the special forces and the Sunni people that we bought and paid for with U.S. tax dollars as part of the surge, because that's as least as big of element to the success of the surge as anything, that they've now aligned themselves with ISIS. And I think that has played into the president's announcement today with the new Iraqi prime minister to basically leave a substantive force in place in Afghanistan, because clearly ISIS is already operating in Afghanistan, and I think this is part of that president's legacy, don't you?
Well, yeah, I agree with you. I think there's no good solution. There are only less bad solutions. In the case of Iraq and the Levant, we kind of have to let that situation burn itself out. But the Iranian thing, I think, is very simple. With Iran, what you want to do is humiliate the regime by using air power to knock out their nuclear facilities and take out a few Revolutionary Guards bases. And after you tell them, well, we've just set you back for 2 years, and if you restart it, we'll come back and do it again with precision-guided smart bombs and bunker busters. And with enough raids, you can drill through basically as much reinforced concrete as anybody can pour. Once you do that and make clear to the Iranians they will not have a nuclear bomb because we will simply stop them from having it, you humiliate the regime, you encourage the opposition. At that point, you can hope that Iran might reconstitute itself as a responsible country once it throws the mullahs out. And let them go fight ISIS on the ground if they want. Just take out their nuclear facilities.
Well, if you'll allow me to play devil's advocate for a minute.
Sure.
The scenario that you just mentioned, I don't see it happening quite that way. What would Iran do to Israel? I mean, they would equate any attack from the United States as Israel being complicit. Whether they believed it or not, David, they would take that kind of a public stance and maybe start a war. I mean, a general war. I think that the problem here is that the place is a tinderbox right now as it is. And
Your point is very well taken. You have Hezbollah, which has 100,000 missiles sitting on Israel's northern border, and Hezbollah is a pure instrument of the Iranian Islamic State. So it's certainly possible that in retaliation for American raids on Iran, Hezbollah might shoot missiles at Israel. If Israel were to try to do this alone, to take out Iran's nuclear capacity single-handed, there would almost certainly be that kind of retaliation. I don't know what Israel's capacity is. I simply don't have the information as to whether they could effectively do the job by themselves. No question the United States could. But Hezbollah is in a much tougher situation than it was, because, remember, Hezbollah has been chopped up pretty badly fighting the Sunnis in Syria, the Sunni majority. They've been fighting ISIS, Al-Qaeda, various independent groups. They've taken a lot of casualties. And the problem with Hezbollah is they are a militia. They are soldiers who live in the places where they train. If there were a missile attack on Israel in southern Lebanon, the Israelis would smash it, as they did in 2006, probably with a great deal more force. In 2006, 250,000 Shiite Syrians fled the war from southern Lebanon into Syria. If they did it this time, they'd run right into ISIS and Al-Qaeda and be massacred. So Hezbollah is extremely vulnerable, and the Iranian regime is very fragile. It's true there are things they could do, but I think we're underestimating how easy it would be to smack them and crack them if we showed that what we're capable of instead of combating them.
Yeah.
So, David, in your opinion, though, I mean, I have long been an advocate of doing precisely what you have described, and I'm a guy who's been to war twice, I don't like war. I don't think it's a good thing. We ought to try to avoid it at all costs. But either you make a sacrifice now in a smaller way, or you give a group of mullahs who are crazy an atom bomb, nuclear weapons, to do more than just wipe out Israel, to do many of the other things that you've talked about here. I have long believed that this is the proper course of action. The question I have for you is, do you believe that President Obama would do such a thing working with the Israelis in the remaining time he has in office, or will it be too late if he waits?
Well, I don't know the answer as to whether it will be too late. The question is, how fast can the Iranians develop a nuclear weapon if they have, you know, a bit of wiggle room to do so? That's a technological question. I've heard many different answers from people who know more than I do, so I can't answer that. Obama will never do that because Obama has a profound sense of identification with the Iranians. He thinks that they're part of the civil rights movement. He and Valerie Jarrett, his Iranian-born senior advisor and surrogate mother. There is an Iranian New Year's festival. It's called Nowruz. And Obama sent a message to the people of Iran for Nowruz saying that his wife had made a Nowruz celebration. They even put together the little sort of collection of symbolic fruits, which the Iranians do for Nowruz, in order to show how much they identify with the Iranians. It's pathetic. There's no possible way a man like Obama would do this, because Obama conflates the problems of African Americans, which have a sad and history with real grievances, with the misery of formerly imperial peoples like the Persians, who want to reestablish their empire at the expense of their neighbors.
Yeah. Now that we're onto the subject of Obama, we can switch gears a little bit here. Obama and Israel. This is turning out to be a fairly frightening thing to those of us who have followed international affairs for a long time, in that I have never seen the kind of the attitude coming from an American administration displayed toward Israel. Not even LBJ, David, I don't think, was so hostile.
Oh, LBJ was very favorable to Israel. He liked Israel. He liked the Jewish people. He was a friend of Israel. Richard Nixon didn't like Jews in particular, but Nixon went out of his way to ship extra planes and tanks to Israel during the 1973 war, which was critical for its survival. Now, I agree with you. Obama has a deep hostility to Israel and a deep identification with the Palestinians. He thinks the Palestinian struggle, again, is part of the civil rights movement. The Israelis are the oppressors, the illegal occupiers, which, of course, is not true. And he, as Elliot Abrams put very well, he has stage managed this crisis in order to downgrade relations with Israel. It's all a setup from the beginning.
What are they
capable of
at the UN, for instance? Would they abstain in a vote for a Palestinian state? Would they abstain in a Security Council vote?
I think it's very likely. I mean, I would have doubted it a couple of weeks ago, just because the damage to the Democratic Party of throwing out a bipartisan pillar of American foreign policy in such a cavalier way would have to hurt the Democratic Party. But I'm convinced that Obama and his camarilla, McBama and the weird sisters around him, Valerie Jarrett, Samantha Power, Susan Rice, do not care about the Democratic Party. They don't care about the chances for election of Hillary Clinton, whoever the candidate might be. They are committed in their utopian fervor to transforming the world according to their fantasy, and they will take any risk and do any amount of damage they want to in order to try to accomplish that in a little bit of time they have left. So, yes,
so David,
I think that's highly probable.
So, excellent point you just made. So let me ask you this, pose you this question then. Is the damage that I think you have correctly articulated that is occurring from this, from within the Obama administration, is that damage possible to be rectified, recovered from, by any president in the future, whether Republican or Democrat?
That's a good question.
I mean, from the standpoint of the Israelis, they want nothing more than an alliance with the United States. And if you talk to Israeli security officials, they'll tell you they're just counting the days until the next election, until this maniac goes away, when they hope things will get back to normal, which is, you know, the longstanding U.S.-Israeli alliance, which is in the interest of both parties, and most Americans and most Israelis want. So certainly that's the case. The worst that'll happen is that Israel will be diplomatically isolated for a while. There will be some, there could even be some sanctions against Israel, say, for example, from the Europeans. That will hurt because, something like 35-40% of Israel's trade, I don't have the exact number, but a lot, is Western Europe, so they are vulnerable. On the other hand, Israel has now opened up, you know, huge prospective markets in Asia, particularly with India. The Prime Minister of India, Mr. Modi, as you may have read, sent congratulations to Netanyahu on his re-election in Hebrew. So, you know, the Indians don't care about all this, and there are many other venues. The Chinese are licking their chops, and as you may know, I work for a boutique Hong Kong-based investment bank called Reorient Group. I know a good deal about what the Chinese are thinking. They're hoping nothing more than they can pry Israel away from the United States and get technologies from Israel they can't get from the United States. There's a huge prospective market for Israel in Asia. Nothing is going to shake them. But I do not believe the Israelis would do anything until the next U.S. presidential elections to compromise their relationship with the United States in the long term. If, you know, God forbid, we elected yet another anti-Israel president in the next elections, you know, Elizabeth Warren or, you know, someone horrible like that, then you'd see a collapse of the American-Israeli alliance. I don't think that it would survive two hostile administrations, but I think the probability of a second anti-Israeli administration is relatively small.
Yeah, Hillary Clinton seems to me, anyway, to be lukewarm toward Israel, not hostile. And she would certainly perhaps not take the side of the Palestinians, but be a lot quieter about supporting stuff like the elimination of settlements and so forth.
Well, Hillary Clinton is a hardcore liberal, but there's a difference, like the old joke about, you know, that it's difference between a neurotic and a psychotic. Neurotic knows what reality is and just doesn't like it. A psychotic refuses to believe that reality is there at all. Barack Obama is behaving psychotically. Hillary Clinton, let's say, is deeply neurotic about Israel. She wants the left-wing solution, Palestinian state, which you're not going to get, and she'll be unhappy about a circumstance in which that doesn't happen, but she will not throw out American security interests in the same cavalier way in order to satisfy a utopian agenda.
Yeah. I'm just aghast at the last week or so that we've experienced with this White House. One thing that surprised me was that the U.S. refused to defend Israel before the annual or semi-annual, whatever it is, meeting of the Human Rights Commission, the UN Human Rights Commission, which specifically, I guess, from what I've read, is dealing with the grievances of the Palestinians. Is that unprecedented?
I think there is no precedent for the entire set of accusations which have come through. I mean, the Israeli prime minister says something which the Obama administration misinterprets and twists about Arab voters. The Israeli prime minister says, fine, I apologize for any wrong impression. I want to be the prime minister of all Israeli citizens, Arab and Jew. I mean no prejudice at all to Arab citizens. He makes a public apology, and the White House says, that's not good enough. The White House announces that Israel's presence in the West Bank is an illegal occupation, which has to end. He sounds like Hamas, as Senator Lindsey Graham said. These are astonishing things. And I think if you look at Obama's entire history, and I wrote this about him in February 2008, at the beginning of the campaign, before he was the candidate. Remember, this is a man whose mother married two Muslim men, took him to Indonesia, and then abandoned young Barry with a grandparent so she could go back to Indonesia and save the iron craftsmen of Indonesia from the terrible plague of globalization. This is a left-wing family which profoundly identifies with the misery of the colonial peoples of the Third World as if they were part of the civil rights movement. That is such a deep emotional identification with Obama and his Camarilla, people like Valerie Jarrett and Susan Rice, that nothing is going to dissuade them. Remember William Buckley said when he was told, you're not going to get your conservative agenda, he said, but that doesn't stop us from wanting it. They're not going to get what they want in the Middle East. You're not going to get a Palestinian state. The Palestinians don't want a state. It's ridiculous. Nonetheless, this is what they want, and they will go down in flames trying to get it because they're ideologues.
So do you think, given what you've stated, and you said previously that Barack Obama and Valerie Jarrett and his whole brain trust, they don't really care what the damage is that they're truly doing to the Democrat Party. So here's the question I have for you with that, because I frankly have believed that for some time now. Can the Democrat Party recover from that very well-articulated damage that Obama is doing to them right now?
Well, the Democratic Party could lose an election over that, hypothetically. In other words, even though foreign policy is a very small part of what Americans are concerned about on average, there are a lot of people in the United States for whom the Israel issue is a deeply emotional issue, both Christian and Jew. A lot more Christians
That's
in America
right.
than Jews, of course. And that could be enough to swing the election. Now, of course the Democratic Party can recover. 4 years is an eon in American politics. We have short memories. But it could certainly cost them the election. And the interesting question to watch is, what will Charles Schumer do now? What will Congressman Israel do now? You have old-fashioned pro-Israel liberals who will vote for abortion rights and vote for Obamacare, but are not ideologues on the scale of the Obamoids. What are the Democrats going to do to try to save their party and their election? A lot of things could happen, which might surprise us, to make Obama's agenda a lot harder to achieve than he thinks. There are many ways to skin this cat, and Democrats may turn out to be surprising in this regard. Now that they've got a lame duck, they could turn on him in a big way. So very hard to predict what's going to happen. We have to see what the Democrats, the sane Democrats, decide to do now that their leader has gone off the rails.
Yeah, that should be an interesting
Don't ask me
period.
To predict it. You know, they're the ones with the sleepless nights. They'll have to figure it out without my advice. But I can tell you, there, Chuck Schumer is not having a happy week.
Yeah, that's for darn sure. Plus, he tweeted the other day about National Puppy Day, which I guess was a couple of days ago, and he wants to introduce a bill that would cut the cost of pet medication. Obamacare for pets.
Well, that sounds like the sort of thing Schumer would come up with, but maybe he should focus on National Sick Puppy Day and invite Obama to be the poster boy.
There you go.
Uh,
got about 10 minutes left here. I wanted to start a conversation about the Iranian nuclear deal itself. Now, none of us really, we know the specifics from Prime Minister Netanyahu, from press reports and so forth. But what we don't know is how much we're giving away in these final days before the deadline for a framework agreement emerges. And that should be worrisome, because the Iranians have been insisting now publicly that there will be no deal unless all sanctions are lifted. No deal, not even a framework agreement, but all sanctions have to be lifted before they'll even sign a framework agreement. Is this a blessing in disguise, David? I mean, we're not going to do that, are we? I mean, how could Obama actually get away with something like that?
Well, Tolkien said, evil will oft evil mars. And it's quite possible the Iranian regime and its fanaticism will miss an opportunity to pull off something sneaky. This is something that's just beyond my capacity to predict. We don't know how close the Iranians are to developing a nuclear weapon or how fast they could get it if they had a clear road ahead. Our own track record of predicting nuclear developments on the part of other countries is terrible. Remember, Wendy Sherman,
yes,
who was our chief negotiator with Iran,
right,
was also the chief negotiator with North Korea. And back then, you know, we said, oh, they'll never get a nuclear weapon. Then when they did, we said, oh, you know, gee, that's too bad. We didn't predict Pakistan getting a nuclear weapon. I know for sure that we didn't predict India getting a nuclear weapon. I know the fellow, the journalist, whom Indian intelligence called 3 hours before and said, by the way, call CIA and tell them we're going to do a nuclear test later this evening. So our own U.S. intelligence has a very poor track record. It's hardly reassuring. Of course, the Iranians may be sufficiently incompetent that they can't get their act together for some time, which gives us a bit more leeway to deal with it. I simply don't know, and I don't know anyone who can give me an adequate answer.
So, David, what do you make of the reports today that the Israelis were not really spying? I watched James Woolsey talk about that earlier today. But listening in and having some inside information on the U.S.-Iranian negotiations here, that certainly wouldn't surprise me, given, you know, Jonathan Pollard and all the things that have happened in times past. But what surprised me was that they shared that information with members of Congress.
Yeah.
Oh, well, you know, the Israelis have said they developed the information by bugging the Iranians and various other places. Now, frankly, to figure out the U.S. negotiating position does not take tapping the phones of American diplomats. Lots of other ways you can do it. I think this is yet another manufactured crisis, which the Obama administration has concocted in order to downgrade the relationship with Israel and establish grounds for doing so. Every country in the world which has diplomats uses confidential information obtained in one way or the other try to influence its diplomatic positions. That is a normal activity of diplomacy. Of course, if you know Israeli diplomats had done a black bag job at the State Department, you know, broken into the premises and planted mics or something, that's something we'd probably object to quite strenuously, but I haven't heard anything to that effect.
No, and the Israelis themselves let it be known that the French have been a lot more forthcoming in filling them in on details of negotiations than the United States. And, you know, the idea that we don't spy on the Israelis is of course, absurd, because we you know, they're one of our main targets, I'm sure,
keeping track of their army
along the border and stuff, yeah.
Yes, we're shocked to find intelligence gathering going on. The French are an interesting element here. I mean, there are two things motivating the French. One is they like to think they matter. I mean, they don't, but they like to think that. And being able to throw a monkey wrench into negotiations, whether temporarily or for real, enhances their sense of importance. Also, the French have a serious shot at becoming a major arms supplier to Saudi Arabia. The French went around the world for years trying to peddle their $100 million fighter plane, the Rafale. Nobody would buy it. The Indians thought they'd buy it and then decided not to. They had no foreign sales, and all of a sudden the Egyptians ordered a couple of dozen of them, which, of course, are being paid for by the Saudis. So the likelihood that Saudi Arabia is trying to encourage the French to take a more rational view of these things against their enemy Iran by giving them billions of dollars of arms orders, you know, one would never think the Saudis would use underhanded tactics like that. I mean, just unimaginable.
Yeah. Let's spend the last few minutes on a little lighter note. You wrote a brilliant column. Time for a national conversation about why Starbucks coffee is disgusting. And first of all, I couldn't agree with you more.
I gotta quote this
here because this is too good. There's a sucker born every minute, and he's almost certain to be an American. We are boosters, enthusiasts, tent evangelicals, fly-by-nighters, snake oil salesmen, and honky-talkers as a people, and get swindled every time. Now, to tell a man that his coffee is disgusting is just a tad less offensive than explaining that his wife really is a shaved chimpanzee.
By the way, I mean no offense to people who are married to shaved chimpanzees, just to clarify, but go on, Rick.
Oh, my goodness.
But you're absolutely right. They burn the beans. They don't roast them. They burn them. And somehow people are convinced that this is a coffee. It's not.
Well, they just don't know any better. Really, real coffee, which I mean, of course, Italian coffee. Everything else is mediocre by comparison. Real coffee is much more like bitter chocolate than like the garbage you get at Starbucks. It's rich, it's aromatic, it's bittersweet, it has many overtones. It's chocolatey. It's delicious. You savor it. You need a lot of very high-quality coffee, roasted, not too much, and a little bit of water or steam shot through it, and you get this wonderful aromatic liquid, which restores the soul. Americans don't know about that. They think, espresso, sophisticated coffee is strong, and Starbucks gets away with second-rate beans and burns the hell out of them, which is why you have to put tons of milk into it. You can't drink the stuff as it is. I mean, ever go into a Starbucks and order a single-shot espresso? It's really disgusting. So you put tons of milk in it and then tons of sweetener and various syrups and other things, and then, you hold your nose. You close your eyes, you pour it down to the back of your throat so it won't touch your tongue, and you pay them $8 for the privilege. So my point is, if they want to have a dialogue with me about race, I'm ready for it, but only if they give me a decent cup of coffee first. Someone wants to have a dialogue with race when I'm drinking a lousy cup of coffee, that is not going to end well.
Absolutely. We've reached the end of the hour, unfortunately. And on that note, we'll have to say goodbye to our guest, David P. Goldman, a Spengler. David, thanks for joining us again.
Rick, thank
it's
you
always
so
a
much.
To have you.
Always a pleasure to talk to you. Jeff, great to talk to you.
Thank you much, David.
Okay,
enjoyed
great.
It very much.
Thank you. Good evening.
Was that good
that was
or what?
Good. That was fantastic. I could just imagine the thoughts going through your brain as a true rhino, Rick, when the moment he said he was a great admirer of Ted Cruz.
Nobody can be perfect.
You're right. Not
but
even
he
you.
Is a brilliant, brilliant man, and he's always gracious with his time. I wonder how many other radio shows he gives 45 minutes to. Probably not too many.
Probably not too many. I have to say that the piece he wrote about Iranian history and culture,
yes,
I never knew. And I'm just astounded by that. I mean, in some ways, Rick, it doesn't surprise me, but what outstanding scholarly research he did. There's no question about it.
Yeah. Well, Jeff, we'll have to say goodbye. It's been a pleasure, as always.
I look forward to the next opportunity to yell at you.
And I look forward to that also. I'd love to get my hide tanned.
And I may have, I may have some very interesting news for you regarding the cruise campaign the next time we talk.
Well, don't tell me you're going to become campaign manager.
Oh, no. They already have that role filled, I'm told.
Oh, well, okay. Well, coordinator in Oregon. That's great. I'm looking forward to that, Jeff. I'll await that news with bated breath.
I thought
you
would.
In the meantime, you take it easy, son. We'll talk to you later.
Thanks, friend. Bye-bye.
Bye. And join me again next week, same time, same place. Bye-bye.